Iran and Russia finalized an agreement for the construction of a mega railway project that connects the two countries via Azerbaijan. Several Palestinians are injured in yet another Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Canada voices support for South Korea to counter what they see as nuclear missile threats by the North. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story, Iran and Russia finalized an agreement for the construction of a mega railway project that connects the two countries via Azerbaijan. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi was present at the deal's signing ceremony held in the capital, Tehran. Raisi hailed the construction of the Rasht Astara Railway, calling it an important project which will benefit both countries. Russian President Vladimir Putin joined the ceremony virtually. He also emphasized the significance of the project and promised that Moscow would put all efforts to complete it. The Rasht Astara Railway will complete a south-north corridor that connects southern Asia to northern Europe. It will have a leading role in facilitating transportation and transit. Elsewhere, Israeli forces and settlers have raided an area near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, injuring several Palestinians. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us earlier with the details.
This morning, dozens of Israeli settlers raided Nablus, raided the eastern part of the city, to storm Joseph's tomb, Qabr Yusuf, this site that is considered very sacred by the Israelis, and that they are not allowed to enter it because it's inside the city of Nablus. It's surrounded by Palestinian neighborhoods. However, they raided this site, of course, under protection from the Israeli military, who also were there with their guns and raided the site as well to make sure that the settlers are protected and safe. Clashes erupted between Palestinian fighters and Israeli forces during the raid. At least six Palestinians were wounded by the fire of Israeli forces. Five others sustained injuries as they fell down while they were, attacked by the Israeli forces. The Palestinians say that they will do their utmost in order to make sure that the settlers will not again enter the Joseph's tomb that is sacred by the Palestinians and Muslims as well. The Israeli forces had also set, a number of checkpoints around the city of Nablus.
Israelis are racing to obtain passports as the regime's recent bloodshed in the Gaza Strip and Palestinians' retaliatory strikes have caused havoc among them. Israel's interior minister has called the situation a passport crisis, with reporting a major logjam of people applying for or renewing passports. It has prompted the regime to launch Operation Passport Marathon and create appointment-free passport counters, which will be operating for a month. On the first day of the operation alone, over 6,000 passports were issued. That's according to official figures, though. Israeli media claim the surge in passport demands is due to the backlog caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, but a survey conducted last year showed Israelis are becoming more and more worried about their future. That's due to the growing might of Palestinian resistance forces, a cost of living crisis, and the power struggle inside Israel. Well, the Gaza Ministry of Agriculture says the blockaded Palestinian territory sustained $1.3 million in damage during the latest episode of deadly Israeli aggression. The ministry said Israeli airstrikes damaged agricultural products and irrigation system, dealing a severe blow to Palestinian farmers. The ministry called on the international community to work for the removal of Israel's embargo on Gaza. Israel attacked Gaza for 5 days, beginning on the 9th of May. The onslaught left 33 people dead, including women and children.
Gaza Strip, and yet again, another Israeli deadly aggression on the blockaded territory that finally ended following an Egypt-brokered truce on Saturday. The five-day onslaught claimed the lives of over 30 people, including women and children. The Palestinian fatalities included several Islamic Jihad commanders. Khalil al-Bahtini, the commander of the Al-Quds brigades in the northern Gaza Strip, Tariq Azzedine, a spokesperson for the Islamic Jihad, who also managed retaliatory operations in the West Bank and Gaza, and Jihad al-Ghannam, secretary of the movement's military council, were all among those assassinated along with their families. A total of 51 Palestinian houses were completely destroyed, while about 1,000 others were damaged, prompting many people across Gaza to become homeless.
Now we are homeless, so we have no choice but to sleep on the street. Everything of us is ruined. I am worried about my children and other family members.
I demand compensation following this ceasefire because we are living on the streets now, no house or anything. My children and their children have no home. We are all left with nothing.
The conflict marked the worst episode of fighting between Gaza's resistance factions and the Israeli regime since the 10-day war in 2021. The carnage was to the extent which drew reaction from the United Nations. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the Israeli regime's onslaught on Gaza as unacceptable. The UN chief also called on the Israeli regime to immediately stop the bloodshed. Guterres said Israel must abide by its obligations under international humanitarian law, including proportionate use of force and taking all feasible precautions to spare civilians and civilian objects in the conduct of military operations. The UN chief also censured the Israeli closure of Gaza border crossings, which prevented the entry of foodstuff, medical supplies, and fuel into the besieged coastal territory.
During the past several years, Palestinian resistance groups have managed to enhance their military capabilities in the face of the Israeli adventurism. The latest aggression and the assassination of resistance commanders not only has increased the resolve of the Palestinian resistance against an occupying regime, but it has also united all factions in their struggle to liberate Palestine.
The latest Israeli aggression on Gaza brings to the spotlight the power and strength the Palestinian resistance groups have attained during the past several years. A joint statement by resistance factions in Gaza is a testimony to that. The statement said their retaliatory rocket attacks and the steadfastness of resistance fighters messed up the regime's calculations during the recent onslaught on Gaza. It added the new round of fighting with the occupying Israeli regime further strengthened the resistance front. The Zionist enemy mistakenly believed that the time was ripe for assassination of Palestinian resistance leaders, but it was a grave miscalculation. The umbrella group said that the Israeli military officials had planned to wrap up the latest onslaught on the Gaza Strip in a very short span of time, but were stunned by the scope of resistance fighters' preparedness and rapid response to air raids. The groups warned Israel against the implementation of the policy of targeted killings, adding that resistance fighters have their fingers on the trigger and will not hesitate to respond in case the regime in Tel Aviv resorts to assassinations. But with Israeli officials admitting that the Islamic Jihad fired 6,000 rockets toward the occupied territories, it seems that the power of Palestinian resistance has already done the job, creating fear and threat among Israeli authorities. With all the fuss about the Israeli Iron Dome, numerous Palestinian rockets managed to intrude into the airspace of the occupied territories and inflict their stated losses. The death of an Israeli settler as a result of those rocket fires during the recent conflict was an indication of that. What seems to be of very high significance is that assassinating Palestinian commanders will not bring security to the Israeli regime and instead will enhance the extent of resistance on the part of Palestinian factions and increase their resolve in the face of the Israeli atrocities. That not only will cost Israel a heavy price in case of any gross miscalculations, as resistance leaders have put it, but will undoubtedly challenge the existence of an occupying regime.
An international conference dealing with Palestinian struggle has been held in Rome. During the event, a number of jurists discussed ways to set up an effective network of legal experts that would better defend the Palestinians' rights. Max Shively reports from Rome.
On Tuesday, an international conference called Palestine and International Law was held at Rome's Palestinian embassy. The initiative was attended by jurists and international law experts from across Europe. All guests agreed that in the face of recent overwhelming geopolitical changes in the Middle East, international law must be profoundly revised.
We came in here because we have a good opportunity to create a lawyer network to defend the Palestinian cause at the same time where they defend our rights to live and to implement the two-state solution.
The Palestinians' rights to self-determination and freedom of movement and the right of not being subject to forced evictions and arbitrary detention, these and other issues were the focus of the Conference on International Law held in Rome. In October 2022, a UN Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territories found that the Israeli occupation is unlawful under the international law. The Commission called on the UN General Assembly to request an urgent advisory opinion from the International Court of Justice on the legal consequences of Israel's continued refusal to end the occupation of Palestinian lands.
The ruling of the International Court of Justice is due in the coming months, and it will be a momentous decision as the geopolitical scenario is rapidly changing. Israel's occupation of Palestine is clearly in breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention. The indefinite permanence in the territories and the Israeli government's de facto annexation policies have led to a gradual emptying of Palestinian communities, which began 75 years ago.
Interesting developments with China and Iran and Saudi Arabia talking to each other now outside of the American power system. I think that that will create a new dynamic, and I think there is an opportunity now for different actors to come onto the world stage.
Also, trading activities by illegal settlements in the Palestinian-occupied territories were discussed during the conference. Luxembourg-based Manuel De Veer was the lawyer behind the EU's historic decision in 2021 to end trade with Israel's illegal settlements. This way, stop trading away the sovereign rights of occupied people over their homeland and resources.
To be able to sustain an occupation in time, it has to be economically sustainable. So to be able to settle your population, you need to provide jobs, you need to provide economic activities. Once you've provided them that, you need a market actually to export, to sell your goods that you produced. And in the case of Palestine, that's very clear that for me, the settlement policy of Israel is depending on exports to international markets.
The UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, Francesca Albanese, has recently said Israel treats the Palestinian territories as its colonies, stressing that getting as much land as possible for Jewish-only people is leading Tel Aviv to commit numerous violations of international law. Max Civili, Rome.
The North Korean leader has accused the United States and South Korea of escalating confrontational moves, saying Pyongyang reserves the right to self-defense. Kim Jong-un made the remarks while inspecting the country's first military reconnaissance satellite. North Korea says it has built the satellite, but it is yet to launch it. During the inspection, Kim urged officials to speed up preparations for the launch. North Korea has unveiled a number of military capabilities in recent months. Those include new, smaller nuclear warheads, a nuclear-capable underwater attack drone, and an intercontinental ballistic missile capable of striking anywhere in the U.S. The hyped-up military activities came amid U.S. and South Korean military exercises, which the North says are rehearsals for a, quote, all-out war. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says his country is ready to partner with South Korea to defend it against North Korea's nuclear and missile threats.
Canada is committed to supporting the Republic of Korea's efforts towards a denuclearized, peaceful, and prosperous Korean peninsula. We will continue to call on North Korea to return to dialogue and diplomacy.
Addressing South Korea's parliament, Trudeau also urged North Korea to abandon its weapons programs and resume denuclearization talks. He said Canada is committed to increased military engagement to fend off threats to regional security. He said Ottawa is ready to boost partnership with Seoul on critical minerals and clean energy projects as well. Trudeau arrived in Seoul on Tuesday. This is a first visit by a Canadian leader in 9 years. Trudeau will hold talks with South Korean President Yoon Suk Yeol later on Wednesday. Former British Prime Minister Liz Truss has urged the UK government to get tough with China over some issues, including Taiwan.
Recently, there have been too many mixed messages from the free world. We need to end that ambiguity. This is because there are still too many in the West who are trying to cling on to the idea that we can somehow cooperate with China on issues like climate change as if there's nothing wrong.
Truss, who was on a 5-day visit to Taiwan, called the self-ruled island the world's most consequential place. She also criticized her successor Rishi Sunak and other Western governments for their idea of cooperating with China in different fields. China has decried Truss's Taiwan trip, calling it a dangerous political show which will harm Britain's interest. Tensions between China and the West, the U.S. in particular, has risen over their growing military and political support for Taiwan. Beijing regards the island as its own territory under the One China policy. China often conducts military drills around the island as a warning to Taiwan's separatist forces and their collusion with external powers. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though.
Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
After coming to office despite making false promises regarding immigrants, U.S. President Joe Biden has adopted the same extremist policies as his predecessor Donald Trump. Meanwhile, Amnesty International has said the United States has once again taken the wrong approach to responding to the global refugee crisis. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Reuters news agency has covered this story and tells us more. The Biden administration began implementing a sweeping policy shift at the U.S.-Mexico border on Friday, 12th of May, as a COVID-era order that had allowed the swift expulsion of many migrants expired and new asylum restrictions took effect amid confusion and uncertainty. Several last-minute court actions added to questions about how President Biden's reworked border strategy will play out, with advocates filing a legal challenge to the new asylum regulation as it was enacted. Facing concerns that the end of a 3-year-old order, known as Title 42, could further strain U.S. border facilities, cities and towns, U.S. officials were keeping a close eye on the movement of migrants that had already reached record numbers in recent days. U.S. Department of Homeland Security official Blas Nunes Neto told reporters on Friday, 12th of May, "We continue to encounter high levels of non-citizens at the border, but we did not see a substantial increase overnight or an influx at midnight when Title 42 expired." Seeking to discourage migrants from traveling to the U.S.-Mexico border, the Mexican government said its National Migration Institute has ordered its officers not to issue immigration documents or other permits enabling travel within the country, creating another obstacle for migrants. Though a chaotic race to U.S. border ports of entry on Thursday, 11th of May, appeared to have given way to relative calm on Friday, 12th of May, there was a sense of confusion among some migrants. As the U.S. border fence dividing El Paso, Texas from Mexico's Ciudad Juarez, hundreds of migrants who had slept there overnight formed a single file line to be brought into the U.S. by authorities and put on buses. Texas National Guard, state troopers and border agents patrolled the area. Immigration advocates represented by the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, filed a legal challenge against the new asylum bars, claiming they violated U.S. and international laws. Advocates argue that the new regulation put in place by Biden's Democratic administration to curb illegal crossings resembles restrictions imposed by his Republican predecessor Donald Trump that they had successfully blocked in courts of law. U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas defended the Biden regulation, claiming it aims to encourage migrants to enter using legal pathways. Alejandro Mayorkas told MSNBC, "It's going to be a tough transition." U.S. asylum officers hurried to figure out the logistics of applying the new asylum regulation. Further complicating the new U.S. policy, a federal judge in Florida ordered the U.S. Border Patrol not to release any migrants without first issuing them formal notices to appear in immigration court. The Texas Attorney General later asked the federal judge to do the same. The website of Globe and Mail has also covered the same story. In chaotic scenes on Thursday, 11th of May, migrants scrambled to enter the U.S. before the new rule went into effect. The regulation presumes most migrants are ineligible for asylum if they pass through other countries without first seeking protection elsewhere, or if they fail to use legal pathways for U.S. entry, which President Biden has expanded. Tens of thousands of migrants in recent days waded through rivers, climbed walls and embankments into U.S. territory. Lindsay Taxolowski, director of Immigrant Defenders Law Center, one of the groups suing the Biden administration, said the new asylum policy was extremely disappointing when people's lives are in the balance. According to the National Border Patrol Council, a union for agents, around 25,000 migrants were being held in U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, facilities near the U.S.-Mexico border on Friday, 12th of May. About 10,000 migrants per day were reported crossing illegally over the past few days. Unaccompanied children are exempt from the new regulation, and advocates have warned that parents might send children across the border alone. Former U.S. President Donald Trump first implemented Title 42 in March of 2020 as COVID swept the globe. The order allowed American authorities to quickly expel migrants to Mexico or other countries without a chance to request asylum. Some Democrats and immigration advocates say Joe Biden's new regulation is too harsh. The measure also counters previous statements Biden made in 2020 on the campaign trail when he said it was wrong for people not to be able to seek asylum on U.S. soil. Joe Biden, who campaigned on reversing Donald Trump's policies and is now running for re-election in 2024, kept the order in place. Migrants have been expelled more than 2.7 million times under Title 42, although the total includes repeat crossers. Mexico has generally only accepted certain nationalities, its own citizens, migrants from northern Central America, and more recently migrants from Venezuela, Cuba, Haiti, and Nicaragua. So during the same period, around 2.8 million migrants ineligible for expulsion were allowed into the U.S. under a process known as Title 8 to pursue immigration claims. Republicans fault the Biden administration for easing Donald Trump's more restrictive policies, while the Biden administration has blamed Republicans for blocking legislation to reform the U.S. immigration system. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. As Title 42 pandemic-era rule ended at midnight on Thursday, 11th of May, Alejandro Mayorkas, the U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security and a former Cuban refugee, issued a stern warning to would-be migrants, saying, "People who arrive at the U.S.-Mexico border without using a lawful pathway will be presumed ineligible for asylum." In many ways, Alejandro Mayorkas' statement directly contradicted some of the promises U.S. President Joe Biden made as a candidate during the 2020 presidential election. Then Biden had pledged to dismantle Donald Trump's hardline immigration agenda, calling the numerous restrictions his rival enacted to shut off access to the U.S. asylum system as cruel. After taking office, Joe Biden reversed some of Donald Trump's border policies, including a program that required asylum seekers to wait in dangerous Mexican border cities while their cases were being reviewed by U.S. courts of law. But for more than a year, President Biden kept and defended in court Donald Trump's most sweeping border restriction, the Title 42 emergency order that allowed agents to cite the COVID-19 pandemic to quickly expel migrants without hearing asylum claims. The Biden administration on Friday, 12th of May, started implementing a rule barring migrants from asylum if they don't request refugee status in another country before entering the United States. Advocates suggested that such a restriction mimics two Trump-era policies known as the entry and transit asylum bans, which were consequently blocked by courts of law. As a result, the new restrictive border control has already been challenged by the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, and other immigrant rights groups in federal courts of law. In its effort to dissuade migrants from traveling north, the Biden administration has also partnered with the Colombian and Panamanian governments to create regional processing centers to screen migrants who could be eligible to enter the U.S. legally.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Spotlight, I'm Marzia Hashimi.
Thanks so much for being with us. Well, it has been 15 months since the start of the Russian-Ukraine war, and still there is no end in sight. Moscow initiated intensive attacks on Ukraine overnight. Even the head of Kiev's military administration has written that Russia had conducted an integrated attack in the Ukrainian capital, describing it as exceptional in its density. All of this as Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has been making his rounds in Western capitals and ramping up more support for Kiev in anticipation of an upcoming Ukrainian counteroffensive. Well, what does it all mean? We're going to be taking a look at that on this spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Out of New York, Andrei Dobryansky, Communication Director, Ukrainian Congress Committee of America. And Daniel McAdams, Executive Director, Ron Paul Institute, Lake Jackson, Texas. Thank you both for being with me. Well, let's start this off in New York. And Andre, do you think this war could have been avoided to begin with? What would have had to have happened to avoid it?
The entire world was warning the Russian Federation not to do what it did. And the Russian Federation lied repeatedly to the world that it would not do what it has done. In fact, Russia was chairing the UN Security Council in February of 2022, seemingly thumbing its nose at all international conventions. We know what would have prevented this is if the world had acted sooner in stopping Putin's ambitions, whether it was his first, his 50th, his 100th political assassination throughout the world, whether it was bombing campaigns on his own territory, invading other sovereign countries, and letting it finally come to the largest country in Europe. Now we see how much work there is to make sure that the international order is restored, and that, frankly, is going to be the best way to ensure that future conflicts like this won't happen.
Daniel, your assessment of it all, do you think that this could have been avoided?
Absolutely, it could have been avoided. You have to go back to at least 2014 and maybe down to the end of the Cold War when NATO should have been disbanded as the Warsaw Pact was disbanded. Its reason for existing ceased at the conclusion of the Cold War. But at the very least, you can go to U.S. interventionist foreign policy in the region. U.S. involvement in the Orange Revolution in the early 2000s in Ukraine set the stage for what we finally saw in Maidan, which was a U.S.-backed coup against a democratically elected government. Excuse me?
You're using disinformation there. I'm sorry.
Okay, Andre, just let Daniel talk. I'll give you a chance to respond.
Why don't you just relax for a second, okay? U.S.-backed coup. We saw the U.S. senators, John McCain and others, taking the stage. We saw Victoria Nuland, who now has a senior position in the State Department. They were obsessed with overthrowing the government in Ukraine because the real target was overthrowing the government in Russia. So they've used Ukraine, sadly enough, as a battlefield for their desire to regime change Russia. And now hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians have died in it. So yes, it could have been stopped if the U.S. did not pursue an interventionist foreign policy and stop trying to rule the world.
Andrei, what did you want to say? Go ahead.
I'm sorry, you need to correct the record about this coup language. This is a live-streamed event that happened over the course of 5 months from November through February, and encampments remained throughout most of Ukraine throughout the end of March. I was there personally. So we can argue about foreign policy intervention, but using the words that the Russian Federation used as a pretense for their invasion is clearly a bit of disinformation. So that's what we need to make sure we're correcting the record there.
Okay, well,
you're not correcting anything because you're wrong. You don't correct somebody. You're wrong. It was a coup in 2014. It has nothing
Were
to do with
there?
What the Russians said.
Have you
so
been
what?
To Ukraine?
So what?
Have you been
so
to Ukraine? Have you been to Ukraine?
What does that have to do with
anything?
Okay,
let's stay on topic. I don't think we have to visit a particular place to have a perspective. But let's look at the overall situation. Andre, would the United States have allowed a hostile power to put missiles on its borders? Let's start from there.
What missiles were put into Ukraine?
I want to know, as NATO expanded eastwards, okay, and in Russia continued to say about the threats that were coming closer and closer to its border, would the United States allow a hostile power to be on its border? Let's start from there. In Mexico, again, in Canada.
No countries were hostile to Russia prior to the invasion. There were no missiles put onto Ukrainian territory. And in fact, over five bilateral treaties were broken between Ukraine and Russia. No defensive armaments and placements were on Ukraine's border with Russia. This is, you know, clearly not a great analogy if you're talking about the, you know, former friendship treaty between Russia and Ukraine that was violated by Russia in 2014 and continues to be violated every day. It's been recognized by the UN Security Council. It's been recognized by a majority of United Nations member nations. I think it's very obvious what the facts are on the ground.
Andrei, had not NATO agreed, we go back to the 90s, and the United States and NATO had agreed not to expand east. And if we look at from the disintegration of the Soviet Union, and we look at it and we bring it on up till today, the number of countries that have actually joined NATO, and that the Russians felt that it was a threat, and that the United States and the NATO countries were not keeping its word. Because there are some who say that after the disintegration of the Soviet Union, the Cold War was over. There was actually no reason for NATO to exist, because we know the Warsaw Pact at that point was dismantled. So there are many that would say there was no reason for it to exist. So do you not agree that NATO did not keep its word, that the United States did not keep its word about eastward expansion?
I don't know what document you're citing about keeping its word. I did cite several international agreements between Russia and Ukraine, international multilateral agreements by all member nations of the United Nations, the Helsinki Final Act, numerous transgressions that were made by this invasion. Okay. Whereas keeping the peace in Europe through multilateral treaties, which is what NATO is, keeping the peace in Europe for the longest period of time in all of history is the benefit for all mankind, so that we don't have another world war. That was the whole purpose for setting up these international multilateral agreements.
Okay.
And so that's what we need to recognize when we're talking about what happened, what exists in Europe today.
All right,
and
let me get Daniel back in on this conversation. Stay with me, Andrei. Okay. Daniel, go ahead. Your thoughts.
Well, we already know from history what would happen, and it wasn't even on our border. It was when the Soviet Union attempted to put missiles in Cuba, 90 miles off of our border, and the U.S. was ready to go to nuclear war with the Soviet Union at the time. So it's obvious, it's very, very clear that the U.S. will not tolerate a hostile neighbor that's well-armed by a far, you know, thousands of miles away partner. It's something the U.S. wouldn't tolerate. The U.S. practically went insane a few months ago when it thought some Chinese balloons were flying overhead. So the fact is, it wouldn't tolerate it. We know for a fact that the gentleman in New York, whatever his name is wrong, because we know that from 14 up until the Russians moved in, that NATO was arming and training Ukrainian soldiers to fight Russia. Angela Merkel herself said it. The reason why Minsk 1 and 2 were not implemented, we wanted to have some extra time so that we could move more weapons and do more training. The goal was always to overthrow Russia. You can't sow the wind and be upset when you reap the whirlwind, because that's exactly what's happening. If you move missiles, if you bring countries into an alliance that's aimed against Russia, and then finally at the very end, at the very last, when you've been warned 15 or 20 times and you punch someone in the face and they punch back, you can't say, well, gosh, that doesn't seem fair. You know, it's not rocket science here.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, and Andrei, is the United States using Ukraine to fight its proxy war against Russia?
I don't know what to say about that. I mean, this is not punching people in the face. This is genocide. This is women over the age of 80 getting repeatedly raped next to their husbands.
Yeah. Children as young as... Cut the propaganda.
Children
as young as four... talking you're getting from your buddies in
children
D.C.
as young as 4 years old being sexually violated by Russian soldiers. And this has nothing to do about people's feelings.
The woman who brought that up was in the UN and it was already completely debunked. I mean, this is a waste of time. I mean, you're just, these are talking points that are handed to you by the neocons in D.C.
That's okay, stay with me, Daniel. Go ahead, Andre. I'll give you a chance, Daniel.
Again, we're talking about an existing multilateral set of rules for everybody to partake in. What happened in Ukraine is that its sovereignty was violated, as other neighbors of Russia's sovereignty
by
was violated.
This has nothing to do.
This has nothing to do with missiles being placed there, because no nuclear missiles were placed in Ukraine. And if we're talking about countries who should be afraid, it is the countries and the neighbors of Ukraine, which rightfully felt that it's best to be in a military alliance where if you attack one, you attack all. And that is what Ukraine has made very clear by being in support of all NATO missions since 1996. This was made very clear at the Bucharest summit in 2008. Ukraine has constantly been deploying their own soldiers in support of other missions throughout the world. It signed on as the first nation. Next year will mark 30 years since Ukraine signed on to the NATO Partnership for Peace.
Okay.
This was the real dismantling of terror within Europe and making sure that countries work with each other. And it is one country above all, one country that has begun to invade other countries and must be stopped by the international community.
All right, let me get you back in on this. Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, the fact is very clear. The U.S. was behind a coup in 2014, as the U.S. has done, certainly under the Obama administration, in places like Syria and in Libya and elsewhere. The U.S. was determined, and this is a doctrine of the neocons, determined to maintain itself as a hyperpower, and taking down Russia as a threat, and now taking down China as a threat, are clearly on their radar. NATO is not a defensive alliance. Ask any Libyan how it feels about NATO. Ask any Serbian how it feels about NATO as a defensive alliance. It's clearly an offensive alliance. The reason again, the war is happening is U.S. involvement, U.S. meddling, the attempt to take down, and also countries like the Baltics and the Poles attempting to settle old scores, maybe get a little bit of territory out of this whole thing in the end. Certainly the Poles are hungry for Western Ukraine. So the whole issue could have been avoided. It was unnecessary. The problem is you have a lot of extremists in Ukraine. They like to wear these funny symbols on their shirts that mark back to a previous time in history. They like the SS. They like the Nazis. And that's a real problem.
I mean, Andre, we're talking about... Daniel, talk. One second, Andre. Daniel was talking about 2014. One second, please. Stay with me. Daniel was talking about 2014. I want to go back to 2014 because we know, I think we all recall the leaked conversation by the Assistant U.S. Secretary at the time, Victoria Nuland, and basically very much showed that the U.S. was very much involved in that situation that was taking place in Ukraine, and basically said to F the EU, if we recall, basically what she said. So how can you not say that the U.S. Was behind, whether we're talking about the 2014 coup and so many of the things that have happened since then? Is it not that the Ukrainian people are actually being used by the Americans in this situation? Your assessment?
Ma'am, I must ask you to correct yourself when you're using words like coup. The international record does not reflect that.
Agree with me. Oh, my God. Correct yourself.
The international record does not reflect that. We saw that
Which
for
record?
5 months. And again,
Which record?
And again, if you were there in Ukraine, you would know all of the conversations that were happening for 5 months instead of this one conversation that you seem to cite that was released by the Russian government.
It's very inconvenient for you,
isn't it? As opposed to 24 hours of people occupying squares throughout all of Ukraine, from the westernmost part to the easternmost part, people putting themselves into danger.
What about those snipers at the end?
People putting themselves into danger after every night. There are still hundreds of people who remain disappeared from the very beginning in November and December of 2013 that we still do not know where they were disappeared to, where they are buried, where their bodies are. This revolution is a revolution for dignity that began with ordinary citizens standing in the middle of the street, as opposed to what you seem to be citing, which is one conversation from February reacting
Andre,
to
it's
an
not one conversation. It is. There are many records with this. And, of course, you start with 2013, and we can look at 2014. We can look at the Donbass. And we have so much information in dealing with that. But let me concentrate on what is happening right now.
So cite something.
With what is happening right now, Daniel, and Western nations committing more money and more powerful and long-range weapons to Ukraine. How do you see this? Do you think that this will actually help Kiev gain the upper hand in the war? Or is this simply just prolonging the war and increasing the fatalities? How do you see it, Daniel?
That's exactly what it is. Ukraine had no chance from the very beginning, and I think the U.S. knew it and didn't care. NATO knew it and didn't care. There's no way Ukraine can win. We've seen endless waves of new wonder weapons. It was going to be, you know, this and that and the other. Now it's going to be this. They've not made a choice. They've not made a difference because Russia views this as an existential war, a war of choice on the part of NATO and the U.S. So, no, it will not change the tide. We've just seen Bakhmut fall nearly today. I think there's one building left. Bakhmut falls, and then the whole line of defense falls. And then we'll see what happens from there. But thousands and thousands of young men, and very young men, who you can see them being snatched off the streets in Ukraine by the thugs who are forcing them into conscription. You're seeing old men being forced into conscription to fight and die for a thugocracy.
Why would the United States do this?
Well, Victoria said it, F the EU. I mean, that's exactly what the U.S. has done. They've F the EU completely. I mean, Germany is now a deindustrialized country. It's a third world country in Europe. I never thought I would see that happen. The U.K. is not far behind. So it's a mad dash to maintain world hegemony. But in the meantime, the whole world is de-dollarizing, and that is also an avoidable outcome of this ridiculous U.S. attempt to overthrow the Russian government. It's going to be the end of the U.S. economy as well. So the world is changing completely and fundamentally. It's not just in Ukraine. The entire global South, you have Iran and Saudi Arabia talking to each other, reestablishing diplomatic relations in Syria. And all of this is in response to what's happening with the U.S. and NATO goading and destroying Ukraine in an attempt to get to Russia.
Okay. Andre, how likely is it that this war could actually expand and directly involve other countries and the danger of all of this?
This war has already affected other countries. Obviously, first and foremost, with the countries who are spending a percentage of their GDP in supporting Ukraine. But more importantly, the people who are struggling with malnutrition and lack of food, that has already led to some governments being destabilized throughout the world, specifically in South Asia. The governments of North Africa and the Middle East are very much being looked at, given the fact that the amount of food supplied by both Ukraine and Russia to those regions has been drastically cut down because of this unnecessary war, this unprovoked genocidal attack on Ukraine that has spiraled into consequences for other nations. And that is part of the reason that the entire United Nations, the vast majority of nations, 141 nations, have voted to make sure that the grain transit from the south of Ukraine through the Black Sea is uninterrupted, and it remains blocked by the Russian Federation to this day.
Well, Daniel, as Western forces seem to be cranking up the war machine even more, we have countries in the global south, some African countries and China now, that are trying to push for peace. Both Russia and Ukraine have agreed to talk to these both groups. Let's talk about these efforts and the possibility that this could be resolved diplomatically.
I mean, the Chinese have come through, and it's not really a peace plan, but it's a proposal to begin discussions and talk about security, talk about regional security, which is what President Putin asked for before they decided to go into Ukraine. Let's have a discussion about security. We are tired of NATO expanding up to our borders. We are tired of these countries getting armed. We're tired of Poland and Romania having missiles aimed at Moscow and St. Petersburg. We need to talk about it because it's unnecessary. We need to stop escalating the war talk on the part of NATO. And nobody listened. They refuse to listen. They refuse to take him seriously. Oh, he's bluffing. He's bluffing. They say, no, this is an existential issue for us. We don't want to be surrounded by a hostile NATO. And no one listened. And now we're seeing what happens when you do something very stupid that doesn't help our country whatsoever. It doesn't help Western Europe whatsoever. And then you blow up the pipeline so they can't even get oil. So it's an absolute disaster. The U.S. foreign policy, as you know, is run by neocons. They have no reverse gear. They only know how to accelerate. And that's why I fear for the future of the world. And I hope to God that the Chinese and the Africans do find some way to settle this peacefully in a way that Russia feels like its security is guaranteed. And whatever remains, if anything remains of Ukraine, can also live in peace.
Andrei, what about you? Are you optimistic about these two groups in trying to reach some type of diplomatic agreement? Or where do you see all of this going at this point in time?
At this point in time, there have been significant military gains by Ukraine throughout this past month. We saw that the main river in the country, the Dnipro, had been crossed by Ukraine's armed forces in the south. Around the majority of Bakhmut, those forces have fallen away, given the fact that they're private contractors by Russia who are fleeing the conflict as we speak. So the fact is that the military equipment and armaments that have been provided by Ukraine's allies have really helped Ukraine, in fact, of getting its sovereignty back. That will be the end point of this conflict, will be all of Ukraine's territory being recognized as it is by the world today, by almost every international body recognizing that there is sovereign territory and that belongs to Ukraine.
Okay.
Hey,
and
I got $100. I'll bet you on that one, right? I'm happy to make a couple $100 off of this.
And Daniel, where do you see this?
I do not bet on genocide. This is you know, really beneath the civil discussion.
Daniel, hey,
what is it going to take, Daniel?
Where do you see this going to end this war?
Unfortunately for Ukraine, it's going to get worse unless they realize that they are run by a corrupt dictatorship in Kiev who does not give a darn about citizens. The real power in Ukraine is held by psychopaths and Nazis. The opposition parties are banned. Any non-state media is panned. They even went after the church and are hassling and forbidding the practice of religion. If this is our democratic ally, I would hate to see an autocratic adversary. This is not a country worth fighting for. This is not a leadership worth fighting for. It's a corrupt oligarchy. Everyone knows it's corrupt. Everyone was talking about how corrupt it is right up until they decided to make Zelensky a saint for a lot of reasons, including financial reasons for the West. So it's these mythical gains by Ukraine. I don't know what this gentleman is talking about, but Bakhmut is about to fall at the cost of probably 100,000 Ukrainians. And after that, it's up to Slavyansk, and we'll see what happens after that.
And the sad part is that the regular people just continue to die on both sides. And I thank both of you for being with me out of New York, Andrei Dobryansky, Communications Director, Ukrainian Congress Committee of America, and Daniel McAdams, Executive Director, Ron Paul Institute, Lake Jackson, Texas. Thank you both. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Hope to see you right here next time.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, an analysis on the thoughts and speeches of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. With me in the studio are two guest speakers for today's discussion, Brother Ali Alevian and Brother Suhail Sarani. Brother Suhail, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Assalamu rahmatullah. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Brother Ali, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me here.
So Brother Mahmoud, the producer of this program, dedicated this new series of the program Viewpoints in the whole month of Ramadan to the topic which is rarely discussed, we can say, in the academic fields and also Islamic fields, and that is the book Nahjul Balagha and the significance of this book as tackled by the leader of Iran on different occasions and his different speeches. When you get to the text of Nahjul Balagha and through the character of Imam Ali alayhi salam, you want to know Islam, I think you have an authentic source now. But when you get to Nahjul Balagha and the very character of Imam Ali alayhi salam, then you can find how practical could a person be and be obedient to his master, that is Allah, and then the Prophet of Allah, that is Prophet Muhammad. Exactly. This is unfortunately what is missed in today's world, you know. When we want to refer into the interpretation of Islam, we start from the various scholars that live in our contemporary time.
You know, in one of the tradition, I would paraphrase that Imam Ali alayhi salam says that know the truth and you will know the people of truth.
Mm-hmm. People
so,
of truth,
so
that's right.
There's the right methodology of knowing, you know, looking at Islam, that you need to know the truth,
mm-hmm.
and then you will know who were on truth and who were those personalities.
That's
and
right.
Very rightly mentioned in one of the tradition, we also see that, and again I'm paraphrasing, where our Holy Infallible Alayhi Wasallam says, if you present our sayings and our teachings to people as they are, then the beauty of them would make people follow us. You know, so that's very obvious. Like when you present the content to the world, and they'll definitely, you know, Rehber also mentions in one of his speeches that those who are, those who are criticizing Islam, or those who have some issue, and then they are pinpointing each and everything about Islam.
That's right.
Before doing that, I would like to tell them, and he clearly mentions that, you know, go and tell my words to them. Go and say them, tell this to them, those who are like, you know, in the Reformation, you know, quote-unquote, like they call
That's
it,
right.
call themselves as reformative camp or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Go between them. And, you know, tell them that, you know, before doing this criticism, read once this book, Nahjul Balagha, and then see if you can criticize.
That's right. Any comments?
I just want to take this opportunity to say one word to the brothers or sisters who are listening to us, and to say that in case, I'm talking to all the Muslim brothers, whatever they are and wherever they live, whether they are, for example, follower of the Ahlul Bayt or not. They are from Shia or Sunni brothers and sisters. I want to tell them, if they want to look at the history of Islam in a just manner, by a just person, I just want to recommend them to read this book of Nahjul Balagha. Actually, Nahjul Balagha, the importance of history is quite clear to everybody, that if you work in the history, specifically the history of Islam, actually it works like a torch of guidance for you. So it's good to know the history of Islam first. But if you want to, for example, regardless of what faith or what sect you are following or what your beliefs are, just see this book and read this book and see if the person who is actually talking to you and narrating the history of his time is just or not.
In fact,